open the February 6, 2014 meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Good morning to everyone. We have a very full agenda this morning and literally not a minute to spare. I just want everyone to know that there are at stake here some very high stakes. And I have, as have other committee members, been approached by members of the public, a good number of them, from both sides of this bill. And I am very pleased and very proud that both sides have conducted themselves in an orderly fashion with the greatest amount of respect. And I thank you for that, and I look forward to continuing to treat each other as fellow Oregonians throughout the hearing and throughout this process. Before we move to the informational meeting, we have one individual. Has Mr. Toppin made it into the room yet? Not seeing that.
He's on his way?
Okay. Directly, or
yes, he's headed right down.
Yes.
Momentarily. Why don't we stand at ease? We have someone who's traveled a very long ways with a trailer full of bulls who've decided that their frustration with the process, they've turned on each other. So. Welcome, sir. Good morning.
Good morning. My name is Bruce Topham, for the record. I want to thank you for putting me on first.
Absolutely.
I have a trailer with four bulls on it out here that are fighting. And once I get them moving again, I can keep them off balance, but they're not moving right now.
There's a lot of bull and a lot of fighting in this town sometimes.
Amen.
That was too easy.
Yeah. It's right
anyway,
away.
With regard to my testimony, my family bought our cattle ranch in the Spring River Valley in 1972, and we have resided there ever since, developing a rare herd of beef cattle that produce both breeding stock and grass-fed meat. Our livestock are marketed from Mexico to Canada and as far east as Illinois and Missouri. In 1964, I graduated from Cal State University at Fresno, magna cum laude with a degree in geology.
Mr. Topham?
Yes.
Excuse me, please, sir. In my haste to get you out of here, I neglected to formally open this meeting, which I am obligated to do. I am going to open a public hearing on several bills, House Bill 4064, 4044. We are open, and, sir, I apologize for interrupting you.
Shall I pick up where I was?
Please proceed.
All right. I graduated from Cal State University, Fresno, magna cum laude with a degree in geology. This education fit well with our family ranching business as it trained me in groundwater geology, a field I have practiced for 50 years. Upon moving to the ranch 42 years ago, I was impressed with the abundance of water. Artesian wells and springs were found throughout the area. My interest was such that I quickly assembled all the well logs and geological reports available in our valley. I showed up at most drilling sites and became acquainted with the drillers in the area. I became quite knowledgeable on the geologic structure and groundwater characteristics of our valley. Soon I was in demand for locating well sites, renovating old wells, conducting field studies, and writing geological reports on groundwater matters in the area. All I have seen and all I have learned flies in the face of OWRD's current computer model on the subject. A case in point, I was commissioned to research and report on a local irrigation well that, when started, dried up a spring in 20 minutes. These two were more than a mile apart. At the same time, another well situated only 400 feet from the production well was unaffected all summer long. This is a very clear example of the complexity of the geology in our valley. Porosities are quite variable. Groundwater can be compartmentalized. Aquifers and confining strata are often faulted and of limited extent. Groundwater conditions are localized and quite variable. One local well is 1,700 feet deep and produces 30 gallons a minute of 53-degree water. Less than a half a mile away, another well has artesian flow of 300 gallons a minute at 70 degrees from only 1,100-foot depth. There are no springs warmer than 54 degrees in the area, yet this warm water well is scheduled to be shut off for interfering with something. But the water doesn't show up anywhere. It's the only warm water there, and it's not on the surface. While on this subject, what is so sacred about a one-mile limit on interference? I have documented groundwater, surface water interference over distances greater than 2 miles, and I have seen pumped aquifers underlying surface water bodies totally impervious to each other. My point is, the science and field observations do not support the OWRD computer model or their theories. They have no scientific basis for their capricious and arrogant behavior in shutting off perfectly sound irrigation wells. This is an example of an out-of-control bureaucracy on a power trip, my opinion. The damage they can inflict on our valley, as devastating as it is nothing compared to the havoc that will be wrought throughout Oregon when they apply the same tactics to the rest of the state. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Mr. Topham. Committee members, please consider that we're very pressed for time, but I also want to be able to allow very important questions if you have them. Do you have questions or comments? Mr. Topham, I recognize that you have traveled a very long way, sir, with some very trying conditions. Wish you the best of luck in the rest of your journey. Thank you for coming all that long way, and thank you for carrying the bull out of Salem.
Thank you very much for getting me out of the way. I really appreciate it.
All right. With that, I am going to open an informational session on water rights law. And with that, I would like to call forward, please, Janet Newman. And Janet, if you have anyone else, please feel free to bring them forward as well. If you have anyone else that came today, okay, thank you. Please proceed. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you. Chair Witt, members of the commission, I'm Jan Newman, currently senior counsel with the Tonkentorp Law Firm, where I work with the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Group, concentrating in water law. But perhaps more relevant for today's purposes, until a few years ago, I was a member of the faculty at Lewis and Clark Law School, where I taught water law and other subjects for nearly 20 years. And I've authored a book, a treatise on Oregon water law, that was published in 2011. I'd like to thank Representative Witt for inviting me here today. What I'm going to do is give you a very condensed summary of water law, of Oregon water law. I'll try to outline in the next several minutes the basic framework of the law that governs water management in the state to provide you with some background for these bills that you're going to be considering. So buckle your seat belts, and here we go. But I'd be happy to take questions at any point at the chair's leisure, of course.
Thank you.
Before talking specifically about current Oregon water law, I want to set out some very quick big-picture context. First of all, when a lawyer says, I do water law, they generally mean that they deal with the law of water quantity, not quality, so with allocation of water rather than regulation of what's in it. And in fact, the legal systems for managing quantity and quality are still quite bifurcated for historical reasons. And that's because water was viewed as property to be divided up and an important resource before it was viewed as pollution to be cleaned up. So for those same historical reasons, water law is primarily state law because it's considered a branch of property and sometimes tort. And that's where the basic resource allocation principles developed. So what we have is a set of water allocation principles stretching back a couple of centuries, developed largely within state courts and legislatures, and then juxtaposed on top of that a relatively newer scheme of water quality regulation that stretches back only a few decades and originates largely in federal laws. So you can see some tension already. And in addition to federal pollution laws, we also have the juxtaposition of other federal laws and doctrines pertaining to interstate water development, for navigation, flood control, reclamation, and Supreme Court cases governing the allocation of water between states and, very importantly, water rights for Indian reservations and other reserved federal lands. And those are principles of federal law that are imposed on the state system. Another important legacy of water law's historical development is that we generally have two overarching systems of state water law, one in the east and one in the western states. The breakdown is roughly along the 100th meridian of longitude, which, if you think about the Great Plains, it goes right down the middle of the Great Plains and cuts off the Oklahoma Panhandle. That's how I always remember where it is. And that's about where the natural precipitation changes. East of that line, you can support agriculture without irrigation. West of the line, precipitation drops below, 20 inches a year, and you need irrigation. So the east was, of course, the first to be settled by Europeans, and when it came to disputes over water allocation, they pretty much borrowed the principles of English common law, which included the so-called riparian system of water law. I'm not going to go into detail about that, but the important thing about it is that it's a share and share-alike system that works very well in places where there's generally plenty of water. As the development moved west to the more arid states, or arid parts of states, those principles weren't so useful, so new principles were developed, and the prior appropriation doctrine is the major water law development for the arid states. And that's not a share and share alike. It's a first in time, first in right, use it or lose it basic system. Oregon historically recognized both doctrines. The wet areas of the state were generally developed first, and the riparian doctrine is used to resolve disputes among actual riparians living along watercourses. And then as the dry areas developed, prior appropriation was used to sort out rights among appropriators, especially if they were on public land and didn't own any riparian land. In 1909, the legislature adopted the first comprehensive water code, and it chose the prior appropriation doctrine going forward. So from then on, you would get your water right under the prior appropriation doctrine, and it was a permit system, so you had to first come and ask the state for permission to start using water. Before that, it was essentially a just-do-it model, if you will. So the code, which is largely unchanged today, I mean, there have been some important refinements and additions, but it's still the basic structure that we adopted, or that your predecessors adopted in 1909. All water belongs to the public. You must have a permit to use it. And it's sort of a two-step process. You get a permit, you then develop your water according to your terms of your permit, you prove up your water use, and then you get a certificate which represents your sort of official water right. At first, the code just applied to surface water. So starting in 1909, it was just surface water. Groundwater was added in 1927 east of the Cascades, and then statewide in 1955. And again, prior appropriation was chosen as the doctrine for allocating groundwater as well, first in time, first in right. the idea, which I'll come back to in a moment, is that the whole system could then be merged when it needed to be, because everybody would have their priority, both ground and surface water. Of course, there was a lot of settlement and water use before 1909 and before 1927 in the eastern part and 1955 statewide. So the code also provided an adjudication process to deal with these pre-code rights. And a general stream adjudication is what it's usually called for surface water. A basin adjudication is what it's called for groundwater. And the purpose of those processes are to determine all the rights for anyone who claims a pre-code use of water. Because there was a lot of settlement, a lot of water use before the permit system went into place to start providing records of water use. So the adjudication system is, its purpose is to determine and declare those pre-code water uses into and make them fit into the permit system or fit with the permit system. It's a two-phase process. I mean, some of you know about a lot more about this already probably than you do, but many other aspects of water law. It's a complicated and lengthy procedure. The first phase is administrative with lots of hearings and contested hearings handled by the Water Resources Department, and then the process moves into court for judicial review as well. Some adjudications took place, you know, very soon after the code was adopted around this, in different river basins around the state. Others, such as the Klamath, were begun much later. The Klamath was begun in 1975, and there are some basins in the state that have not yet been adjudicated, so there are still these sort of inchoate pre-1909 claims. Every water right, whether it's decreed in an adjudication or included in a water right certificate, has several specific fixed components. Source of water you're entitled to divert from, an amount of water, a type of use, a beneficial use, a place of use, a point of diversion, a time of use, and most importantly, your priority date. That's sort of what puts you in the system. And then the regulation is done by the Water Masters and by the Water Resources Department according to those priorities. Whenever they can, and I know that the department is here to talk about this in more detail today, but whenever they can, they try to recognize when the hydrologic system is interconnected so that they can try to regulate in priority between surface water and groundwater also. Obviously, we know less about our groundwater sources than we know about our surface water sources, and that's always a continuing problem to, you know, get enough data to know when the connection is there and that you need to coordinate the two systems. So all of those elements I listed are integral to your right, and in order to change any of them, you have to get state approval, and that's called a transfer, even if nothing is actually changing hands. But any of your components can be changed in a transfer proceeding. That process reviews your requested change for injury to other water rights. And so it's very, you know, carefully analyzed to see if you can make a change without affecting others in the priority system. One last thing I'll say about Oregon's water law. Since adoption of the Water Code in 1909, water law issues are very tightly interwoven with general administrative law principles, because now you have an agency with permitting decisions and administrative rules and administrative processes that where much of the water law decision-making takes place. So the decisions that the Water Resource Department makes on new applications for permits, on issuing certificates, you know, whether someone has proven up their water right, water use adequately, on transfers, on injury reviews, and in adjudications are all governed by the State's Administrative Procedures Act in Chapter 183 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, as well as, of course, by the Department's own rules, and then a great deal of case law interpreting both Chapter 183 and the various aspects of the Water Code. So the administrative law procedures currently set out certain processes that need to be followed, certain requirements for notice, hearing, contests, protests, and so forth, and applicable standards of proof and procedural rights for the various water holders. So that's a really, 25-cent summary of Oregon water law, and I'd be glad to entertain any questions in whatever time I have left.
Thank you so very, very much. Questions or comments for Dr. Newman? And again, please be cognizant, committee members, of our time issue here this morning. Anyone? Representative Krieger?
Could you give us that last minute and a half of what you just said? That last minute and a half?
The administrative law piece?
From about there to the end.
Okay. Yes. Ever since the passage of or the adoption of the 1909 Water Code, we have put a lot of the decision-making authority for water management into an administrative department. So the Water Resources Department, operating under the oversight of the Water Resources Commission, makes many of the decisions. And then there are provisions for judicial review of those decisions once they're finalized. Oregon Revised Statutes Chapter 183 is what's known as the Oregon Administrative Procedures Act. It applies to agency decisions in the state, and it sets out specific requirements for the kinds of hearing processes you need, the kinds of processes you need to follow when you adopt administrative rules, and it also includes evidentiary standards for various types of decisions that are made by agencies. And that is supplemented both by rules that the Attorney General's Office or Department of Justice puts together, model rules that the agencies can adopt, and then also by the department's individual rules about its procedures. And then there's, of course, case law that interprets both the Administrative Procedure Act and the Water Resources Act. So there are specific requirements under current law for standards of proof and decision making.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative? Yes, Representative Whitsitt, please.
So the Klamath adjudication has not had the ability to go through the judicial branch of the government at this time. That's correct.
Correct.
It's only been an administrative decision, and so decisions that the Water Resources Department made have not been able to be challenged in a court of law. Is that correct?
That's correct. They have been challenged through the administrative process. And I should just mention that I do represent one client in the Klamath adjudication, so I'm not here to talk about their issues at all. But
Representative, I don't see this testimony online. Is it available?
We don't have it.
We just handed it out, didn't we?
We have. There are.
I only brought speaking notes, but I can certainly provide them to Beth.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Anything further? Yeah, thank you so very much. We are extremely fortunate to have had the opportunity for you to share your experience and knowledge with us, and thank you for that.
Thank
very
you.
Much.
You're very welcome.
With that, I'd like to please call forward Marshall Gannett and Roy Haggerty regarding water rights and the science of that. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you for the invitation. And we'll be, well, first of all, I'm Marshall Gannett. I'm a research hydrologist with the Oregon, with the U.S. Geological Survey Oregon Water Science Center. I've been with the USGS since 1990. I've been a licensed by the state of Oregon as a registered geologist for about 29 years.
I'm Roy Haggerty. I'm a professor of hydrogeology in at OSU in the College of Earth, Ocean, and Atmospheric Sciences. I have a PhD from Stanford University in hydrogeology and an undergraduate degree in geology. I have practiced this for 18 years here at OSU.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor. I think we see our role here as just to provide sort of a common framework for the discussions that are going to happen down the road. And what Roy and I have tried to do is just very succinctly summarize the important fundamental concepts based on, you know, not just our thinking, but on a rather substantial body of scientific literature that goes back decades on this pretty complicated topic. So our talk is two parts. I'm going to just provide some very fundamental concepts, and then Dr. Haggerty will drill in a little bit more to the interconnection of wells and streams and how those relationships are understood. So I have like four slides. I'm going to start out with some really basic groundwater fundamentals, so everybody has kind of the common language to use. This graph shows just a very simple, generalized cross section of a groundwater flow system. And I think, first of all, to define groundwater, it's water that resides in the subsurface, in the saturated part of rock and strata that fills the open spaces, the fractures and the open spaces between sand and gravel clasts. The important concepts I want to get here are that groundwater moves from recharge areas, which are typically high elevation mountainous areas. It moves in the subsurface and it discharges somewhere, most commonly in low-lying areas, most commonly to streams, wetlands, springs, places like that. So it's always moving, and it's moving from one place to another. You'll notice on this cartoon here, we have different flow paths here shown in these arrows, and they have different time scales ranging from days, years, centuries, and in rare cases, millennia. And a really important distinction to make here is the difference between the travel time of physical water and the travel time of stresses that move through the groundwater system. Mr. Topham, in his testimony, made reference to a spring that responded almost immediately to pumping a well close to a mile away. In my experience, when I've run aquifer tests, I commonly see a response in a well hundreds of feet from a pumping well that will occur within 30 minutes or an hour. So the key concept here when thinking about how wells interact with streams is the fact that, or a key concept, is that these stresses can propagate over space pretty rapidly, and it's quite different than the actual travel time of water. A good analogy is the difference between wind speed, which is the movement of air, and the speed of sound, which is the movement of pressure waves through air. The movement of water, the rate and the rate of propagation of stresses, pumping stresses, is controlled by two characteristics of aquifers that Roy will talk about a little bit more: the transmissivity, which measures kind of the ease with which water can move through the ground, and the storage coefficient, which speaks to sort of how much water is actually stored there. So this is just another little cross-section cartoon here, just to depict water entering the groundwater system through the unsaturated zone, flowing and discharging to a stream. But this could be an agricultural drain. It could be a wetland or a spring. I guess two points I want to make with this slide are that groundwater discharge is the main component of stream flow late in the season, in the summer and fall, when long after the snow has melted, when there isn't much rain. So groundwater can be a very critical source of water for human uses late in the season, and it commonly is. The other point I want to make is that groundwater discharge to streams is commonly evidenced by a number of things that are sort of widely available types of information. One is a water table sloping toward a stream system, and definitely indicates that groundwater is moving toward that stream. Gaining stream reaches, streams that increase in flow independent of tributary inflow, and it's indication of groundwater seepage or spring flow. The presence of springs in areas where there's lots and lots of springs, That's the groundwater discharge we're talking about. That's the groundwater discharge that supports stream flow. Robust late season flows. The Deschutes River is a perfect example of a stream that's almost entirely groundwater fed, and it's chunking along at something close to its mean annual flow there at the Highway 26 bridge in Warm Springs, and that's mostly groundwater. And then upward head gradients, for water to be moving up toward a stream from depth along these flow paths, there are upward head gradients, and I guess one way to think about that is in groundwater discharge areas, artesian wells are very, very common. I guess the main point here is that determining whether or not groundwater is an important component of stream flow is a pretty low bar. It can be understood with a great degree of certainty with widely available information. I have two slides just on the sources of water to wells before I turn it over to Dr. Haggerty. This is a diagram that shows a little cartoon of an aquifer system. The blue is the saturated part of the aquifer, and we show a well here with water that's being discharged. And when a well is first turned on, what happens is the water table around the well starts to become lower. There's a depression in the water table around the well we call the cone of depression. And so when you pump, so what that does is two things. First of all, when you pull that water table down, you're draining part of the aquifer framework. There's water that used to be in between these grains of sand or gravel or whatever here, and it's no longer there. It's been pumped out of the well. So part of the water that comes from a well, particularly when you first turn it on, is water that's drained out of the aquifer. It's water that's taken from storage. The other thing that happens is that when you change the geometry of the water table, you start steering water that would normally be going one place toward the well. And this is all pretty common sense stuff. And so what that does is it means that in addition to some of the water coming from storage, some of the water is water that's diverted from some other place. And most commonly that water is diverted from its discharge area, which is, you know, most commonly surface water features. I guess a real key point here on this slide is that groundwater pumping is a zero-sum game. The water comes from either a change in storage, which is manifested as a decline in the water table elevation, or it is diverted from somewhere else. That's it. It's a zero-sum game. My last slide here to talk a little bit about throwing that kind of well diagram into a diagram with a stream. So this top upper block is just a little cartoon showing a groundwater system with water being recharged at the water table and kind of flowing toward the stream. When a well is entered into the mix, you know, at the beginning of pumping in this middle panel here, again, these downward arrows depict some of the water coming from storage and as the water table forms. But as the water table stabilizes, at some point, water is no longer really coming from storage, and it is pretty much water that's been intercepted that's flowing somewhere else. So before I turn it over to Roy, I'd like to leave you all with three points. Groundwater flows from recharge areas to discharge areas, typically such as springs, streams, and wetlands. Identifying areas where groundwater is supplying stream flow is really easily done using widely available information. It's usually kind of a no-brainer. Water removed from the groundwater system through wells either comes from, one, a change in aquifer storage, which usually is manifested as a decline in the water level, or two, changes in flow to or from boundaries, most commonly streams or other surface water features. And at this point, I'll turn it over to Dr. Haggerty.
Thank you. So I'll just continue on from there. What I'd like to talk to you about is the impact of wells on streams, picking up more or less where Marshall left off. So Marshall mentioned how wells impact streams, and there are two ways in which that happens. The first, where they get their water from. I mean, there are two places. The first of these and the most immediate impact is that storage is reduced. That's the cone of depression, which grows. The second of these is stream flow capture or capture from other surface water. And the proportion in which these two effects happen changes over time. So this graph shows that proportion. The vertical axis is the percentage of the pumping rate supplied from one of those two types of resources, and the horizontal axis is pumping time with no units. These units could be minutes, days, hours, decades.
The reduced storage, the reduction in storage, the water, the amount of water supplied to the well provided from reduction in storage decreases over time, while the fraction of water that is captured from streams increases over time. They always balance each other out. As Marshall said, it is a zero-sum game. This slide is just a simple extension of that, and it relates an important point, and that is that the effects of pumping do not stop when the well turns off. Vertical axis, again, is the percentage of the pumping rate. The first half of the diagram is the same as the diagram before, but one can imagine when pumping stops, what happens. Well, storage is begins to be refilled, and that storage is refilled from continued capture of stream flow. The point here is that there are residual effects after pumping stops. So I want to talk a little bit about what we know and how we know it. So do we know what Marshall and I have explained to you? In overall effects, yes, we absolutely do know this. This is based on nearly a century of research by scientists, including the U.S. Geological Survey. So we know this. Pumping depletes surface water. It's a simple matter of mass balance, like a checking account. When you take money out, it has to come from somewhere. When you take water out of the ground, it comes from somewhere. There's little uncertainty about that. Water is not created or destroyed. Pumped water has to come from somewhere. What is uncertain are the details of the timing. The timing depends on the particulars of transmissivity and storativity, and these do have uncertainty. But I want to show you the overall effects, just to show you the kind of effects we have on surface water. This is a photograph taken in 1942 near the city of Tucson, Arizona. Tucson, Arizona is the largest metropolitan area in North America, entirely supplied by groundwater. Notice the rock in the foreground. There's a river that you can barely see here, called the Santa Cruz River. And that photograph was taken in 1942. Notice the rock. That's the photograph in 1989. Same location, same rock. The difference is the trees. The difference, the trees are dead, and they went away because groundwater dropped 100 feet, and the roots of the trees were not able to supply water to the plants themselves, so the trees have been removed. The river is much, much reduced as a result of the groundwater pumping. These kinds of effects, there's no mystery, and they're fairly certain over longer periods of time. How quickly does that effect of pumping propagate to a stream? Well, the speed of the stream flow response varies with three things. The first of these is really obvious, and I think will not be a mystery to anyone, and that's the distance from the well to the stream. So the pumping well is here, stream over here in a cartoon fashion. If you have a well that's far away from a stream, all other things being equal, then that effect will take longer to impact the stream than a well that's close to a stream. It varies as the square of the distance. But it also varies with two other components, two other properties, and those two properties are those that Marshall mentioned. They're the aquifer transmissivity, which is a function of the permeability of the aquifer, but also the thickness, and the storativity, which is the storage capability of the aquifer. And it varies as the ratio of those. The ratio is transmissivity over storativity. And so for a well in two different aquifers, imagine two different aquifers, one represented by the orange drawdown cone, the other represented by the blue drawdown cone. This is an aquifer with high transmissivity storativity ratio. This is an aquifer with a relatively low transmissivity storativity ratio. And you get different rates of propagation to the stream as a result of that. I want to mention, just before I go on, that the ability to measure the effect of stream flow or the effect of pumping on stream flow is challenging in part because we pump at a certain rate and streams typically flow at a much, much, much larger rate than the pumping rate. If you change the flow of the well, the effect on the stream is small. However, cumulative over time, it can be very large. And for that, because we can only measure stream flow to plus or minus 10 or so percent, the effect of an individual well's pumping on a stream is difficult to measure. We use other methods. The methods we use, there are basically two of these. The first of these are analytical methods. These range from very simple analytical methods like the one that I have up here to more complicated ones. Analytical simply means we have an equation that we can use in a spreadsheet or a calculator. These three components that I just talked to you about, the distance to the from the well to the stream is A. The storativity or storage coefficient is capital S, and the transmissivity is time. This is one example. This stream flow depletion factor here is the amount of time it would take to expect 50% of the pumping is extracted from the stream. Let's get past those. Another method that's commonly used for more complicated situations that allows us to represent greater levels of detail, including things like heterogeneity in the aquifer, meaning things are changing from place to place, is a numerical model. Numerical models are a common tool. They've been used in groundwater hydrology for approximately 45 years. And this is just a cartoon representation of one. This is a very common and well-established method for understanding the impact of groundwater on streams. There are analytical methods with equations that lie in between these two levels of sophistication. We're able to use equations with a calculator or a spreadsheet that encompass things like confining layers. And with that, I'd like to just leave you with three or so points as my key points. That first of all, the most important thing is that pumping always depletes surface water somewhere, sometime. The general behavior, the prediction of overall stream flow effects, has low uncertainty and is relatively inexpensive. It's a matter of mass balance. Prediction of the timing of the stream flow effects has greater uncertainty and is more expensive, and it depends on details that are place dependent and uncertain.
That pretty much concludes our presentation, but before we leave, I just wanted to reiterate that there is, as Roy has mentioned as well, there's a considerable body of science on this admittedly complicated topic going back decades, and a lot of it has been summarized in a USGS circular that came out a couple years ago called Stream Flow Depletion by Wells: Understanding and Managing the Effects of Groundwater Pumping on Stream Flow. It's written for a general audience. It's written for a non-technical audience. I brought down 10 copies of this for the committee that I've left with Val Petrino, and if anybody needs more, or if any members, any of the people in attendance here today would like a copy, get in touch with the USGS Oregon Water Science Center, or just corral me before I leave, and I'll make sure you get one.
Thank you very much for that offer, and thank you so much for your testimony and appearance, Representative Whitsitt.
Thank you. In 2001, a severe drought resulted in the shutoff of all surface water to the Klamath project. Hydrologic models for the water flowing into Upper Klamath Lake was 160,000 acre feet, yet actual inflow to the lake for that time period was 231,000 feet, a difference of positive 71,000 feet. This was modeled by computer with the best available science that you had. And personally, I think that in the Klamath Basin, we cannot use models to determine surface water, groundwater interconnection. And that's a perfect example of a computer model that failed terribly. So I just thank you.
Thank you. Please.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Whitsitt, I just, first of all, I want to make sure that everybody understands that was not the U.S. Geological Survey involved in that. That's the Natural Resources Conservation Service. The other thing is those are the methodologies used for the water supply forecasting in the Upper Klamath Basin are statistical models, and they're not physically based models. So your point is a good one in that all models have uncertainty, and decision making has to go on in an environment of uncertainty. But I did want to defend myself a little bit.
I wasn't accusing you, but it was the federal government. So.
I realize that. But it's a good point.
Thank you very much. Not seeing anything further?
Yes, Representative Clem.
Just let me ask one question. I mean, we can't just have me out there trying to figure it out. So if computer models aren't always, you know, there's some uncertainty, is it the best we've got, though?
Computer models are generally the best that we do have, and there is always uncertainty, but we proceed in our decisions every day with uncertainty. As I said, I'll just refer back to this. There are some things that we have very, very high certainty about. There are other things that we have low certainty about, and you know, that's the way we have to proceed with this.
Mr. Chairman,
please.
Representative Clem, I might just add that it's been said that modeling is about insight as much as numbers. And I think that when grappling with these kinds of problems, models are one tool that can be brought to bear along with, you know, and different types of models, statistical models, numerical models like Roy discussed, or analytical models, the equations that are used. And then, you know, common sense, field observation. So you need to bring the full range of tools to bear on these problems. But models are one of, you know, a useful tool, but one of many tools.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Are computer models such that you described, are they better and more accurate a tool to define interference of a potential interference of a well with a surface water body than actual evaluation of the individual well using hydrologic principles?
The use of an individual well to determine determine interference with stream flow. May I just clarify that, Chairman Witt or Senator Whitson? Is that what you're referring to?
Yes.
It's not possible to determine interference between a stream and a well in general using a well test, and the reason is because the pumping rates from wells are typically much, much lower than the stream flow. So the accuracy of the accuracy or ability to measure stream flow is plus or minus 10%, and the pumping rate falls within that plus or minus 10%. So for an individual well, it's difficult to do it with a direct test.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Then how would the well owner disprove the allegation that his well was interfering with the stream and therefore would needed to be shut off?
How would he disprove the allegation that his well is interfering? Well, it's a matter of balance. It's a matter of mass balance. We know that if the well is pumped, it's going to interfere with a stream. If I spend $100 from my checking account, it has to come from somewhere.
I understand that. But we're talking about a timely and quantifiable interference.
Mm-hmm.
How would the well owner refute that his well is interfering?
It will impact the stream at some point in time.
But not measurably enough for you to determine that it is.
The timing is uncertain.
Thank you.
Additional questions or comments? Gentlemen, thank you so very, very much. We are very grateful for your appearance today.
Thank you for the invitation. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. With that, we had originally scheduled the department to
to discuss the administration of water law. I'm going to ask them, in the interests of enabling time for the public to testify, to include that information in your testimony on the bill at a later point. And with that, I'm going to close the informational meeting on water rights and open a public hearing on House Bills 4044 and 4064. And with the formality, Beth, if you could just give us a very brief synopsis of what's before the public.
Okay, Mr. Chair, just a moment. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, both House Bills 4044 and 4064 are identical bills. They would require the measurement of distance between a surface water source and well location to be determined using global positioning systems, coordinates, and the ordinary high water mark. The bill defines terms and also sets out processes and requirements for the Water Resources Department to follow in making a variety of determinations. There's no revenue impact or fiscal impact statements that have been prepared at this time. There is a subsequent referral to the Joint Ways and Means Committee.
Thank you very much. And at this point, I'd like to request that Senator and Representative Whitsitt please present their bills. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning. It's different being on this side of it. Thank you, Chair Witt, committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to present this bill, or these bills. They are the same text, House Bill 4044. My name is Gail Whitsitt, and I represent House District 56, which is the southern half of Klamath and Lake Counties. The genesis of this bill is that in December of 2013, we were told by the Oregon Water Resources Department that over 100 of the farms and ranches whose irrigation surface water was cut off by the Oregon Water Resources Department non-judicial branch adjudication of the area above Upper Klamath Lake last year would now have the remaining groundwater irrigation wells shut off, perhaps as soon as April 1st of 2014. The window of opportunity to provide some legislative relief to these people is now here in the next 4 weeks. The concept behind shutting off all water to these farms and ranches is that the Oregon Water Resources Department perceives there may be groundwater interference with surface waters in these wells. They propose to cut off the wells as a group and thus destroy the livelihoods of hundreds of people based on a computer model of the groundwater. This is an untenable proposition to me. You've heard the department state, the USGS, that the data they have is sufficient to model for the results they have come up with. For myself, as a multi-degree geologist with professional experience working on deep oil and gas wells for Standard Oil Company and British Petroleum, I do not believe it is with a preponderance of evidence that they can make this determination for each well. The groundwater study they are using is from a 2007 report by Marshall Gannett et al. That covers a region of several thousand square miles in Oregon and California. It is a regional study, and throughout the report, it's peppered with disclaimers. The study has little validity regarding detailed, comprehensive information on specific and individual wells. Actually, the report states that only two complete aquifer tests were undertaken in the entire shutoff region. Those were done in 1977 and 1982. Now, maybe they have additional ones that I'm not aware of. This is an area that covers hundreds of thousands of agricultural acres, yet the agency wants to shut down over 100 wells based on this report and some additional data. Page 8 of the report states, quote, "The report is regional in scope. Thus, data and analysis presented herein are intended to provide an understanding of the groundwater hydrology at a regional scale."
Page 21, the report has a disclaimer stating, quote, data are insufficient to estimate net regional groundwater recharge from irrigation activities in the Upper Klamath Basin, and groundwater recharge cannot be directly measured at a regional scale. My last quote, page 22, estimates of groundwater discharge have inherent uncertainty. One source of uncertainty is the stream flow measurement on which they are based. The need to complete empirical field data sets on porosity, permeability, and transmissivity on each well that represents the livelihood of a family is a necessity to ensure that these farms and ranches are not put into bankruptcy without due cause. My concern as a legislator and a professional geologist is that every single well needs to be analyzed to show the groundwater pumping is or is not interfering with the surface water. And I don't disagree that if it is, it needs to be shut down. Anyhow, that completes my testimony.
Thank you very much.
Shorten it up.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, I'm Senator Doug Whitsett. I represent Senate District 28, which is encompasses all or the major part of five central southeastern counties. The Water Resources Department alleges that a recently completed regional groundwater study model determined that each of these irrigation wells will interfere with the judicial adjudicated tribal in-stream water right. Oregon statute and rule provides that wells constructed between a quarter of a mile and 1 mile from a surface water body are presumed to potentially interfere with that surface water body. However, the law requires the department to prove that substantial and timely interference exists before it can regulate those irrigation wells. The department now alleges that their regional groundwater model meets the burden of proof for all of the listed wells. The department's stated intention is to require the well owners to discontinue the use of the listed wells pursuant to the next tribal call to protect their in-stream water rights. It further states it will regulate based upon the priority date of the well. This means that virtually all of the wells will be shut down before the surface water is regulated. Once the surface water is regulated, all of the water will be gone. The burden of proof that the well does not interfere is then shifted to the well owner. In order to prove that the well does not interfere, would appear to require the well owner to disprove the validity of the entire groundwater model. We just heard testimony a moment ago that, as I understood it, there was really no way that a well owner could disprove that his well was interfering any more than the agency could prove that it was interfering by a particular test. So where does a farmer or rancher, some of these folks sitting behind us, where do they get the financial capacity to try to invalidate an entire regional study? The certain result will be the total dewatering of as much as 120,000 acres or 200 square miles of farm and ranch land that was irrigated in 2012. The arid Klamath River Basin, the loss of irrigation water causes the loss of virtually all of the economic value of that land. As an example, in 2001, when the federal government, with their wisdom and their biological opinions, reallocated the water for the Klamath Project and shut off virtually all the water to the project for that year, the local assessor reassessed that land from $2,700 an acre to $27 an acre. It was a 99% reduction in value. And the Oregon Water, the Oregon Revenue Department upheld that decision based upon the fact that you can't grow anything in the Klamath Basin without water, and two, you can't use the land for anything else under Oregon water or under Oregon land use planning laws. So essentially, when you take the water, you take all the value of the land. So if you start with that, House Bill 4044 proposes to address and solve this problem. Section 1 limits the applicability of the provisions of the bill to groundwater statutes. Section 2 establishes a legal procedure for measuring the distance between a well site and a surface water body. And then the bill goes on. The bill requires the department to prove by clear and convincing evidence that each individual well is actually causing the alleged interference with the surface water body by applying acceptable industry standards determined by mutually acceptable qualified hydrologists to estimate the extent and timing of the alleged interference caused by each individual well. So there's been an allegation that requires three hydrologists. Not really. The way the bill is drafted, the well owner can pick a hydrologist, the department can pick a hydrologist, and those two hydrologists will pick a single hydrologist who will do the hydrological work. The purpose there being to try to reduce bias. But it does only require the work of one individual. The bill requires the department to pay the cost of that determination of interference. The bill provides that in the event the department is unable to establish the proof, it is required to pay damages to the well owner for the loss of use of his well during the time the well was shut off for that to make that determination. And finally, the bill clarifies certain administrative procedures relevant to groundwater regulation. In short, the proposal is to clarify what we believe is currently already required in Oregon law. In a recent letter, the Oregon Attorney General wrote, pursuant to a question that I asked and the department got the letter for me, quote, before controlling the use of any well greater than 500 feet from a surface water source, the department must also determine whether regulation of the groundwater use would provide relief to the surface water supply in an effective and timely manner. That's a direct quote out of the Attorney General's letter. We do not believe that the department's groundwater model could possibly have the specificity to determine that an individual well is causing specific and quantifiable interference in an effective and timely manner. Further, in the absence of that required specificity, there is absolutely no way that a well owner could possibly disprove the department's allegation of injury without disproving the entire regional groundwater model. There are arguably no greater supporters of the Western water law, the doctrine of prior appropriations, and the adjudication process than Representative Whitsitt and I. I mean, we're based in that. There has been concern expressed that the wording of this bill could be construed to include authority to regulate surface water, especially surface water that has already been adjudicated. We believe that Section 1 effectively and completely limits the provision of this bill to statute relevant only to groundwater regulations. That is our intent, and that's the way we had it written. However, as you know, in this legislative process, perspective is often reality. And so we have asked Legislative Council for an amendment to unambiguously limit the provisions of House Bill 4044 and 4064 to the regulation of groundwater. Mr. Taylor has drafted the Dash 1 amendment before you today that unequivocally makes that distinction. We request the committee adopt the Dash 1 amendment and your favorable vote on House Bill 4044. Thank you.
Thank you both very, very much. Questions or comments for our two colleagues? Representative Krieger, please.
I spent, I guess, a total of 5 years at Kanawha Falls between going to OTI and, I guess you would say, in my prior life, pursuing people at night on the on the Hill Road. I think Clyde Dillinger was the first one I contacted. But this is a complex thing, and some of the things I heard today brought some concern to me. I heard the lady testify that water was considered as property. And if you look at some of our founding documents, they talk about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Originally, pursuit of happiness was property, and that was changed. And that shows at the time how valuable property was, because historically, the common man wasn't allowed to own property, and they came to this country for that. I see this as a way of degrading that value. Questions like, would all wells of different depth at different pumping capacity equally affect the stream surface? Does all groundwater enter a stream? For instance, they say, well, eventually they say it does.
But from the upper Klamath, my understanding is the study, the time it gets down to Tule Lake and below, it's over 200 years for that water to get there. So as far as it's being timely going to enter that stream, that's a whole different question. And Mr. Chair, I want you to try to remember back when you and I were on the Board of Forestry. This has come up before. Dr. Sessions, the modeling that was done for us when we were on the Department of Forestry regarding the harvest rate of the Tillamook Class of State Forest, they came up with a number. Then I became a and I questioned that number. I said, no way. I have a tree farm, doesn't forest. No way is that land going to produce that. I get here, first session I'm here. Dr. Session comes in and they're saying, well, our model wasn't too good. Well, how far are you off? 50%. Model is only as good as what you put into it. I told him at the time I can get two loggers from Curry County, drink a case of beer, and I can guess closer than that.
Yes.
And so I was really.
Especially the bird.
These models are. We start relying on them because we don't want to do the work that needs to be done. The department needs to do the work that needs to be done to secure that this property is not taken and that the follow what this attorney general says. If it's that important, then they need to do the work. Don't try to circumvent the process.
Representative, I'm glad to hear how you scale timber here. If we don't get enough, we just drink another case.
So. I love him. This is the best.
Let me make a brief response to Representative Krieger's comments. He's absolutely right. In the Oregon Supreme Court, in their Fort Benoit decision, determined that an Oregon water right is a property right. And our view would be that, you know, the department, through an administrative procedure, and even less than that, through a modeled groundwater study, is taking this private property.
Additional questions or comments? I'm not seeing any. Thank you both very, very much. With that, let's see here. Okay. Representative McLean first, please. And if you could hold on just a minute before you start. Okay. Representative McLean, my apologies. Welcome to our committee. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you to the committee. My name is Mike McLean. I represent House District 55. House District 55 includes the area that will be affected by this. It is everything north in Klamath County of Klamath Falls and everything north in Lake County of Lakeview, and it's a big sprawling district. But I wanted to come to testify on in support what Senator Whitsitt and Representative Whitsitt have introduced, and given, I wanted to start by describing the purpose of their zeal. District 55 is arguably the poorest district in the state of Oregon. Oregon ranks number one in food stamp use. We are number one in the nation per capita in food insecurity, and my district happens to lead the state in that. We're number five in real unemployment in the country, and more than one in five children in Oregon live in poverty. My district is was hit worse than any other district by this recession. Klamath County's budgets have been slashed. In District 55 in Klamath County, as far as folks go, on an economic basis or in a desperate situation. So Senator Whitsitt and Representative Whitsitt could have cursed the darkness or struck a match. And what they did is they struck a match. Because it may not be perfect, but I commend them for having struck a match. Because too long, those who live in rural areas and are enduring 30 years of systemic poverty have been cursing the darkness. But But this bill at least tries something. They may not be perfect. I think the amendment is in the right area, and I would ask you to support it. But I commend them for doing something. And so when we talk about computer models and we talk about flows over historic times, I don't want this committee to lose track that people are in a desperate situation in Klamath County. My commissioners, one of which is here, have written a letter, and it's been submitted to you as an exhibit in support. And I'm here to make sure that their letter is emphasized and Commissioner Malam's testimony is emphasized. I have a couple of issues with what the Water Resources Department intends to do. I doubt they have the legal authority. I think bottom line is a very good argument can be made that under the regulatory and statutory scheme of groundwater regulation, there has to be a declaration of critical groundwater before they act in a way that cuts off these wells. And I see lawsuits coming and a whole lot of expense for the Water Resources Department circumventing a clear statutory path to do what they do. And I would ask that you either pass this bill or hold the Water Resources Department accountable to what already exists. Number two, I would emphasize that the burden of proof is more than just a historic concept for us. I think Senator Witsis is accurate when he emphasized that what does a rancher do in North Klamath, north of the city, and what do they do when they're cut off? How do they prove that it doesn't, that their well isn't affecting surface water? Now, we can sit here and give grand speeches, and there will be a lot of people who will come up and present their views. We know the environmental community has very good lobbyists, very high-paid lobbyists, and they will be here to talk about the purpose of the state and the overall need of the state. And that's their role. My role as a state representative is to emphasize this district. And how do you think a rancher will react in this desperate economic times when you cut off her water and then you say you have the burden of proving that it doesn't connect? And oh, by the way, there is no possible path for you to prove it. Whether that's a taking or not, I'm sure people will lawyer up if they can afford it. But the repugnance that gives the people of District 55 and Senate District 28 is palpable. That we wonder sometimes, why is it that rural areas feel so disconnected to what happens here in Salem? I'll tell you, that's a reason why. Because when they're told your livelihood goes away, the fact that your children have a higher hunger rate than Portland children doesn't matter to the fact that we're going to cut off your well and there's no possible way for you to prove it. So this is a sensitive area. And before we dismiss any bill in the name of the greater good, let's not lose track of the fact that if people don't have a path to secure their property and the future for their children, they don't have a reason to stay involved in our state. And this district has endured too much for too long for this committee not to consider this. Finally, in 2012, I ran a water bill. And so I appreciate that Senator Witsit and Representative Witsit have decided to be the arrow catcher of this short session. I did learn, as the old adage says, that whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. But one thing after that 2012 session, which was very difficult on the water bill I ran then, one thing I learned is this discussion is worth it, because what led out of that was good results from a regional solutions team and a Senate bill that passed. So what's happening here is good. And whether you pass this bill or not, or whether we would somehow direct the Water Resources Department to go through a critical ground study before they, or a declaration before they do this, we need to talk more and more and more about the fact that rural areas are absolutely in a systemic poverty state. And anything we can do, we have to do. And it's not fun, and it's tense, but let's keep doing it for the sake of those people. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Representative McLean, and it's great to have you before our committee. Thank you for your support of all the good folks in rural Oregon. Representative Clem.
Thank you. Representative McLean, trust me, I'm talking now more about timber, but I've sat in this committee, and I wouldn't say I held this match. I mean, I've raged many, many times. But the problem in this particular situation is, you know, we're about to hear from a bunch of farmers and irrigation districts from your district who say this is a mess. This isn't some Portland environmental group. I mean, I'm reading a letter from the Klamath Irrigation District saying, you know, this is a bad, bad way to go about the solution. So I'm with you on let's hear what's a good solution then. But these are local people who are in a rough situation that I've sat in this legislature and tried to figure out what can we do for the Klamath Basin. The best we got, and I don't remember what session it was, 09, something like that, when we sort of ratified what the state's role was going to be in the master settlement. I know Richard Whitman is down there literally every week trying to work this out. This is a bad situation for everybody, and it's not within the state's control entirely, obviously, to solve it. So unless there really is a unified solution from that area where we don't have farmers fighting other farmers over water, which is exactly where we're going to be in a lot more places than this if we don't get our act together on storage and a whole bunch of other things, it's pretty hard to just do something. We got to do the right thing that gets all the people from that area feeling good. That, unfortunately, in water, it, as you said, it's sort of winners and losers. And except to store more and get everybody more later, I don't, you know, that means the state's got to spend a bunch of money, which we should spend, and I voted repeatedly with you to either yank water out of the Columbia, because I felt like in that particular situation, the burden of proof had shifted to the environmental community. You need to come up with something then, because otherwise I'm going to keep supporting taking water right out of that river. You come up with something else, and I'll back off and join the let's get along team. So I hear you. I get very frustrated myself. I mean, our orchard depends on water, but we're right at the top of the glacial pack of Hood River Valley, so I don't have these problems. I will someday, probably, sadly, but I don't. I know what's coming next, and it's you know, half of them are going to be your constituents probably too. So I want to help. I don't know if this is it or not, but
you know, well, I'd respond this way. I appreciate Mr. Chair and Representative Clem. I appreciate Representative Clem your advocacy. I think you and I are often aligned in trying to find solutions, and so I personally want to thank you for that. But Klamath politics makes Chicago look tame. And we have, because of circumstances out of our control, been turned on each other. And it is incredibly unpleasant. So I don't doubt you'll hear testimony that you'll scratch your head and say, what the heck is the unified message of Klamath County? Well, it's this. Help. Now. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Representative McLean. Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call forward, please. Is it Brent Chain? Is that how you pronounce your name? If I butchered it, I apologize.
Well, my name is one where phonics do not help you in the slightest.
Okay. David Oxley and Grant Knoll, please.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Salem. As a project irrigator from Klamath Falls and fourth-generation owner of a century farm, my name is Brent Shane.
Thank you very much.
That being said, I guess it's time for my disclaimer. Representative Clem, I am a member, elected member of the Klamath Irrigation District Board of Directors. And sir, I am here to speak in favor of this bill.
Sir, if I could interrupt just for 2 minutes. And I apologize, but I'm extremely pressed for time. And at this point, I'm going to have to limit testimony to... to 2 minutes.
Perfect.
Okay.
Splendid.
And so I'm going to have to, I apologize in advance to everyone in the room, but we're going to have to stick to the 2 minutes to make it fair for everyone. And I apologize for the interruption. Please proceed.
Understand completely, Mr. Witt. I'm Brent Sheen, fourth generation owner of a Century Farm from Klamath Falls, Oregon, elected to the Klamath Irrigation District Board of Directors Zone 2. My comments are that of an individual citizen. I am not here to represent my board, my district, or any of the other paying patrons other than me. But I want you to be aware that it was a 3-2 vote from the letter that Mr. Clem alluded to. Personally, I make a couple of comments here. Number one, the old timers I grew up with in the Klamath Basin always said, without irrigation water, it takes 10 men and a keg of whiskey to raise a disturbance. Anything short of that, it isn't going to happen. And as I sat looking at the looming specter of zero to very little water delivery in the Klamath Basin, I want to thank you for what you do for our state, because even at that, I don't want to trade jobs with any of you. So thank you for what you do for us. And I have an ag degree in crop production, and you know, I support this bill because I think it's a move to good, sound science. And you know, it doesn't really, in my opinion, change the law. It clarifies the law. And I think the more info we gather on these wells, the better. And there's as much good for this bill for the project, in my opinion, as there is for the off-project people. Because this has the potential, I'm telling you, to mushroom out and take in every ag well in the state of Oregon.
Mr. Chain, I have to apologize, but we're out of time.
Perfect. No apology necessary. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much. If you want to hang tight, we may have some questions.
Oh, okay.
Who's next?
My name is David Oxley, and I live in Klamath County and have land in Po Valley, and I am part of the Klamath Irrigation District and a member of the water users, and I am here to ask for your support on this bill. You know, a lot has been said here today on the issues of, you know, timing of water getting from the stream to the... I don't think anybody... I'm not going to argue the fact that all water is connected somewhere, but it's the timing that's obviously the issue here. And we lost our water in 2001. Many of us lost our water right for the year, that year, and we have had to do things different. My case, I had to go out and secure a second source of water to try and save my farm. Subsequently, in doing that, I became a licensed well driller in the state of Oregon and drilled my own wells and drilled many others in Klamath County. And I can tell you, Klamath County has a lot of different aquifers, a lot of different depths, and a lot of different temperature waters, and it is a very complicated issue. So with that being said, I think you need to realize that the decisions that you folks make are affecting the livelihood of myself, my neighbors. You know, water is it's been stated here that without water we have nothing.
That's right.
And it's very true. And so I can't read anything in this bill that says they're trying to change the law. They're just trying to clarify and hold the water resources accountable. And I think for that is so a reasonable thing when you are talking about our livelihoods. I mean, there's so many issues.
Thank you, Mr. Oxley, very much.
My name is Grant Noel. I'm a KID board member. And and I irrigate approximately 1,000 acres on project and off project. Graduated from Eastern Oregon University 2002 with a range management desert watershed degree and a minor crop and soil science. I am representing Knoll Ranch, second generation farmer, forced to drill well after 2001 water shut off to help keep family farm whole. Basically, our well is a prime example of the USGS. There's a problem with their model. We pump out of a confined aquifer. There's approximately 700 feet of blue clay between the surface water and the basalt, which is basically an impenetrable barrier. And from 2003 to 2009, we pumped the well with no problems. 2010, a problem supposedly arose, and we had the Oregon Department of Water Resources on our front doorstep. They had no proof, no science. They just said, you're basically shutting off, or you're going to reduce the flow of your well. We appealed it. Their reasons being, well was too close to critical water zone. The static of the well is 15 feet. How critical is that area? We appealed again. Well, then they pulled out the trump card. We affected domestic wells, supposedly. I believe with a confined aquifer that we have in our basin, the water comes from a long ways away. The transmission of the water is maybe in the realm of 200 years. We don't know. And the viability of my farm rides on this, and I would suggest that you, for the greater of the good, that you would support 4064.
Perfect, sir. You hit it right on the money. That was perfect timing. Thank you all very much for your testimony. Are there questions or comments for this panel? Representative Clem.
So I assume on the 3-2 vote, you're on the board as well? You're the two.
Yes, sir.
So just, yeah, I mean, I'm reading what the other three said. I don't know if they're coming up, but so you get a chance to respond at least to probably, because you probably won't be back up here again. Let me just ask you this. I mean, it says that the result would be chaos, a regression of the days of the Wild West. I mean, it talks, I mean, there's a real fun board meeting for you guys.
It is providing.
So,
Representative Clem, yeah. We call it our once every 30-day chance to be waterboarded.
I guess my question is, you know, for us sitting here, obviously, it sounds terrible, if somebody doesn't get shut off in the ground, and it's believed that that is linked to the aquifer, isn't somebody else going to get shut off somewhere else? I mean, the problem is there's not enough water to go around, obviously, so they tried to come up with some sort of master settlement that's largely done now. And how do I pick between you three and you two when that kind of language is used?
Well, you're getting paid the big bucks to make that decision.
Thank you.
$1,800 a month, baby.
Sir, I want to thank you for your candor, sincerely, because I am so proud of this committee. I think the members that sit on this committee are as fair a bunch of people as I've seen anywhere. And I just know that it is going to be a very difficult decision for each and every one of us. So I appreciate your comment.
Well, to quote a water district manager in the basin, Don Russell, to be a successful Klamath irrigator, you have to be born wet and under pressure.
Well, very, very true. Any additional questions or comments?
A very quick question, Mr. Oxley and Mr. Sheen. How many acres of land do you farm, roughly?
I have about 200 deeded and rent approximately as much as 800 acres more each year.
I have 400 acres deeded and rent another 500 to 600.
So 3,000 acres between.
Yeah. 3,000 acres right there. Yeah.
Thank you. Seeing nothing further, gentlemen, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Recognize the fact that you've traveled a very considerable distance to get here, round trip, even more. Thank you for your participation.
Thanks for your time. Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Tom Malams, Erica Benson, and Virginia Topham, please.
Good
you. Oh, maybe Mr. Ledford.
Now, can you get how you elect the commissioner when you didn't grow up there?
Good morning to each of you. I have had the pleasure of meeting Mr. Malams, Commissioner Malams, before. Welcome to the other two.
Thank you.
And please, please decide among yourselves how you'll proceed. What order?
Oh, let's get this over with. Sorry, I'm nervous. Good morning. My name is Erica Benson, and I've been a rancher in the Sprague River Valley for 20 years. And I am here to support House Bill 4044. This past summer, I got my first taste of how quickly government restrictions on surface water can ruin the livelihoods of family farmers. I had to sell over 50% of my herd because of the lack of grass. I worked hard to build this herd, and it broke my heart to have to sell them. And now OWRD wants to kill the rest of my ranch by shutting off all the water. If that happens, I'm done. Last summer, wells were the only thing that allowed me to keep as many cows as I could. Where I run my cows, it's the well water is all within a quarter mile of the stream, so I don't have a choice. I'll be forced out of business. And they're doing this without any real proof. There's evidence to the contrary. Geologists can go into that underground stuff, but every water-righted well in Oregon has already had to prove there's no interference issues. We did the steps. We proved up on everything, and now they're just changing it because of this computer model that they thought up, and it's going to ruin our lives, and it's not fair, and it's wrong. Why do they oppose this bill? That's what I don't get. All it does is require them to prove that there's substantial interference. You know, why does this scare this? You know, if there's no interference, of course the well should be shut down. But if they think they have the science to back it up, what difference does this make to them, really? I mean, don't they believe that the field studies will prove up on their model? You here in this room are the ones who are going to decide my fate. This is your call. What you choose to do today is going to affect me forever. Eventually, it'll affect everyone else in this state as well. Politicians are always promising to look out for the little guy. That's me. I'm not a big corporation. I'm not a factory farm. I'm just a rancher, and we're just trying to do what's best for our land and our community.
Erica, I'm going to...
Okay.
Time's up.
Well, I just want to say I wasn't hired to come here to speak. Well, I'm just here because this is going to affect me.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Yes, I'm next. I prepared a 3-minute speech, and you're cutting me down to 2 minutes.
Yes.
In written testimony. I'm Virginia Topham. I raise cattle in the Sprague River Valley. My husband and I bought a ranch 42 years ago. We didn't have a sugar daddy. We built what we have with strong backs and these two hands. We spent decades building a reputation herd. We sell breeding stock as well as retail meat. We try to do things right. We provide our customers with sustainable products. We use solar energy. We irrigate efficiently. We do rotation on our grazing. We love the valley we live in. We've put our roots down there. We've lost our first son there. His ashes are scattered on the ranch. Our remaining children, ages 25 and 27, want to continue this life we started. They'd be here today, but they are at home feeding cattle. Last summer, our surface water was shut off. We were forced to reduce our herd by a third. House Bill 4044 is vital to us. We are a family ranch. What you decide here today will determine my future and my family's future. Our lives and careers are in your hands. So what do I tell my children when I get home? What is your answer? They deserve the opportunity to carry on the family tradition. Do you agree? Will you give them a chance? Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very, very much.
Well, Chairman Witt, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. We have here
the question is, why are we here? We definitely have a problem. We all acknowledge that we have a problem. House Bill 4044 is a solution to part of that problem. I think that cannot be refuted. There's going to be some that will disagree with that, I'm sure. But trying to get a full settlement on all the issues is almost impossible. It's been going on for decades and decades. This is a piece of the problem that can be solved right here, and it's a big piece.
Excuse me, Tom. Did you identify yourself for the record?
No, I don't think I did.
Okay.
Tom Malams, Klamath County Commissioner and citizen. And I have to also say I am an irrigator. So some people will say I have a perceived conflict of interest. I'm a very small irrigator amongst a large pool of irrigators, but I do irrigate ground. So what we have here is a problem of no recourse. This country was founded on one of the principles of innocent until proven guilty, and this is upside down, this process. As Senator Whitsitt said, there is no way that you can prove, as an irrigator, that your water does not affect a stream, possibly, to that kind of scrutiny that they want to put it under. That just doesn't happen. As a county commissioner, I represent all the citizens of Klamath County, include some that are here today that are going to disagree with it, and I have no problem with that. I am a product of that Klamath-Chicago politics. The voters in Klamath County have overwhelmingly agreed with my positions on all of these issues, and I'm going to represent all the citizens as best I can, but I'm going to go with the voters that voted me into office and do the right thing, and I'm going to continue to do that no matter what. And we look at the impacts in the county. Somebody else recognized the budgetary problems that Representative McLean did. The last year's shutoff caused a drastic influence on our budget. If this goes forward this year, it's going to devastate our entire community. Our entire county is going to be decimated. We're under budgetary problems already. The land value in our county, if that goes forward, is going to be the total impact on land values of $500 million.
Tom, we're finished with
Thank
the time. Thank you very, very much. Are there questions or comments for this panel? Folks, like everyone else who's traveled a very long distance, we truly appreciate your input. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for listening.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Dave Kaka, Kirk May, and Jeff Stone.
My name is Dave Chaska. I'm a fourth-generation farmer from the Klamath Project. My family farm's been in operation for 105 years. My family also has owned and operated property on the west side of Klamath Lake in the upper basin since the 1860s. I'm here today to represent the Klamath Water Users Association. It's a not-for-profit corporation that represents 14 member districts in the Klamath Basin. As the bill was presented to us originally, we came out in opposition to 4044 and 4064 because of some of the language that was in the bill that leads us to believe, as written, to originally negatively affect the ability to regulate surface water rights as part of the recently issued final order of determination of the Klamath Basin River adjudication. This is our primary concern with the bill. We believe the legislation has the potential to undermine current Oregon water law as well as Western water law and the prior appropriations doctrine. We do not disagree that the state should have the burden of proof that there's interference between ground and surface water. We believe that is the current law. What that proof entails and whether it's specifically quantifiable to each and every well is a question. And I want to be very clear. We are not here today seeking to have all upper basin water regulated off. No one should be regulated off based on theory. We are here because we are concerned about the effect of this legislation as it is worded on Klamath Project water rights. If the issues related to this legislation's effect on surface water are adequately addressed, we would be happy to work with the sponsors, department, and other interested parties. I want to thank Chairman Witt and the committee for time to address my concerns and our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Chair Witt and members of the committee, I'm Kirk Mauga, water rights attorney at Stoll Reeves. I grew up working on my family's irrigated farm north of Vail, Oregon, and today I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Water Resources Congress, a trade association that represents irrigation districts and other agricultural water suppliers from across the state. OWRC strongly opposes House Bill 4044 and 4064 and submitted a letter to this committee along with other conservation groups, municipalities, and water rights suppliers. Yesterday, I presented a water law course at Lewis and Clark College and talked about the prior appropriations doctrine, it being a first-in-time, first-in-right system. That is, in times of shortage, senior water right holders can place a call to shut off junior water right holders. As Representative Clem has recognized, this isn't an issue of Oregon Water Resources Department versus irrigators. This is an issue of, in times of drought, someone has to bear the burden of the loss. And the prior appropriation system is set up to protect senior water right holders. The bill, as structured, would prevent senior water right holders, senior surface water right holders, from enforcing a call or obtaining their rights against junior groundwater users. What we're talking about here is not preventing someone from using water. It's trying to decide which property right holder is entitled to water rights in times of shortage, and this bill would upend the system that has existed in Oregon for over a century. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, Frederick and Escobar, I'm Jeff Stone. I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. I have submitted a letter on behalf of the Oregon Environmental Council, OEN, and a variety of other interest groups. The Klamath issue certainly is one that, being an Upper Valley membership, is not one that I'm familiar with. And frankly, it is a bad situation no matter how you slice it. So I want to assure this chair and this committee that we would like to be a constructive voice in solutions. And as Representative McLean indicated with his ill-fated water bill back a couple of years ago, it did open a door for a conversation. And I think that that's an opportunity that we have here. And I applaud the Whitsitts, both Senator and Representative Whitsitt, for bringing this forward. Hydrology is scientifically complicated, and we have both surface and groundwater individuals. So we, at the way that this bill is written, we would come out opposed, but I think that it opens a doorway for us to talk about how we integrate the best science, how we get water onto farms. We're an irrigated crop, so we're very sensitive to the needs of farmers to get water on their property. And so I will stop there, Mr. Chair, because you have a lot of other people to testify.
Well,
thank you for your
you.
Time.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, anyone with anything to discuss with this panel? Yes, Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair White. Just very briefly, Mr. Chachka. Does the Dash 2 amendment that unequivocally limits this bill to the regulation of groundwater, does that solve your problem?
Yeah, our issue is with being able to exercise our
there was no intent,
surface water rights.
Yeah, there was no intent for this bill to ever address surface water rights. We don't believe it did. But like I said, the perception is reality. That's why we have this this amendment drafted that absolutely separates it. It applies only to groundwater. And if this Dash 1 amendment doesn't get that done, we'll go back to legislative councils and make damn sure it does.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
We have heard several times this morning that this is a very complicated issue and a difficult call to make. And Kirk, I took note of the fact that your statement, in essence, who gets the water when there's a shortage? And correct me if I'm wrong, but to the best of my knowledge, it has been historic precedent and continued to be followed with the Klamath Water Agreement that the senior rights take precedence in a time of shortage. And is that accurate or not?
Representative Witt, that's accurate.
And would there be arguments for or against, what's the wisdom behind any change to this, to the senior water rights taking precedence in a time of shortage?
What I see is the issue here is about protecting the property rights and the economic investments that senior water right holders have made in their system. So this is a property rights issue, and it's about protecting senior water rights.
To the best of your knowledge, and not only to this panel, but anyone who comes up subsequently, is there any reason why we would want to award precedence to a junior water rights holder in a time of shortage? If we have to make an allocation decision, is there a call to be made and a compelling reason why we award it to a senior rights holder as opposed to a junior rights holder?
Chair Witt, I think if we were to upend that structure, we would be in a situation where there would be taking of the senior water right holders' property interests, and that creates a problem, as you're well aware.
Yes. Thank you very much. Representative Witsit.
I have a question. When you refer to senior water rights holder, are you referring to the Klamath tribes in particular as the most senior water right holder in the Klamath Basin?
Chair Witt, Representative Witsit, I'm referring to all senior water right holders, and that would include under the determination that was filed by the adjudicator in the adjudication, the Klamath tribes. Yes, it would include the Klamath tribes.
As the senior most water right holder, correct, under the adjudication?
Correct.
Okay. And I was just wondering if you're familiar with any other situation outside of a critical groundwater area where a number of wells have been removed at one time without the designation of a critical groundwater area.
I'm not specifically familiar with that. However, in other basins in the state, specifically in the Deschutes Basin, there's conjunctive management of groundwater and surface water, and a clear recognition that changes to groundwater affect surface water.
Right, and they are critical groundwater areas, which we do not have a designation of in this area. So, thank you. Just to clarify.
Thank you. And again, trying to be very clear here, we're preserving or currently the senior water right is preserved statewide. Is that correct? We have up for consideration here not only the folks who face these very, very large challenges in the Klamath Basin, but the policy that we are establishing here and have established is a statewide policy, is it not?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if we didn't believe that this bill had broader application to the rest of the state, if it was solely about the Klamath area, the nurseries would not be up here opining on things that clearly have been under great discussion. Okay. That have not involved us, but we believe that this could have potential impacts statewide. And that's the reason that I'm here.
All right. Thank you, Representative Clem.
Thank you. Just since I've got a legal beagle here, I mean, so let's say even we have these amendments to say this doesn't apply to surface water, but if you're in a groundwater limited environment that's been already settled, that there's this amount of supply, and when it goes down overall, somebody's not going to get some. How do you not regulate surface water if some comes out of the pool?
Chair Witt, Representative Clem, you're absolutely correct, and my interpretation of this bill is that regardless of whether its language is strictly limited to groundwater, it would affect the ability of a surface water right holder to place a call on a junior groundwater user whose pumping of groundwater affects the senior surface water appropriators, right? So I don't believe there is a way that this bill can possibly not affect senior water right holders, surface water right holders.
If you had more than enough water, you probably wouldn't matter. But if you really down to where somebody's going to get turned off, somebody's going to get turned off.
And then we wouldn't have this bill at all.
Yeah.
Senator Woodson.
It seems that you're mixing metaphors a bit here. With surface water regulation, the senior water right holder gets all of his allocation before the next most senior, and that is proper and appropriate. But when you're regulating groundwater under current Oregon law, I mean, you can change the law if you want to, but under current Oregon law, it says that you have to prove that the use of that well is causing a measurable and timely reduction in the flow of the surface water that will harm another water right holder, or you can't regulate them. And that's what this bill's about. It's not about the rest of the stuff. The rest of it's rhetoric. This is specifically what we're talking about.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Whitsitt, I agree with you that there has to be proof, and what we're talking about here is the standard of proof. The department currently doesn't shut off groundwater appropriations without proof. The department currently uses a best available information standard, and that's what has been used throughout the state. This isn't shutting off groundwater appropriations is not new. This is the department continuing to apply a longstanding policy that happens when groundwater appropriations affect surface water. And so this is not a change in policy, and it's not an absence of proof. It is a question about how much proof is necessary.
I would agree with that, sir. The point is that, to my knowledge, and perhaps you can correct me, but to my knowledge, the department has never, ever ruled off 100 wells at one time without doing a critical groundwater analysis, and that is what they plan to do here. And so that is the crux of the matter. What is the level of proof? Is that regional groundwater study that has all the disclaimers, is that adequate proof to destroy the livelihood of 100 farmers? That's the question.
Representative Klemp.
So, because I'm trying to get this a little bit better here. This bill would make it clear and convincing. I don't know what that means in court. I assume you do, or somebody's got to tell me. Because clear and convincing in, we've got some other mitigated areas where I know what that means. But what does that mean here? What would clear and convincing mean in this situation if we go to that?
Representative Klemp, clear and convincing is a much, much higher bar, and it's difficult to say exactly what that's going to mean, but I think the concern is what OWRC's position is, that standard may make it impossible for the senior water right holder to prove that they're being affected. And so I understand the concern of groundwater users about groundwater users being able to prove that they're actually affecting surface water rights, but there's also the problem in reverse, that if we raise the standard to clear and convincing evidence, we may make it impossible for the senior water right holder to protect their rights.
Yeah. Additional questions or comments?
Thank you very much, gentlemen. I certainly appreciate your testimony very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to call up, please, Jazz Adams and Aaron Nutt. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Nott. I'm the Legislative Director for the Attorney General in the Department of Justice. We're here to try to provide some context for the legal terminology, such as Rep. Clem just mentioned. We cannot comment on any pending litigation. I don't think we'll be asked to, but just to clarify.
Need a microphone.
Thank you, Representative Reardon.
All right.
You're heard, hearing too.
And the only other mention I would make is we have heard references to an amendment that I think would help out with some of the points that we're about to make. We haven't seen it, but we'd be happy to revisit once we have seen it. So with that, I'd like to turn the presentation over to the attorney in charge of our natural resources section, Jazz Adams.
Thank you. For the record, Jazz Adams,
the Oregon Department of Justice. The department is neutral for purposes of this hearing and that we neither support nor oppose these bills. We're here today to comment on a fairly narrow slice of the bills having to do with legal aspects of these bills as introduced, and specifically we're focusing on the clear and convincing evidence standard, the limiting the department to its written notice and the proof set forth in its written notice, and also the either the discouragement, I would say, of withdrawing an order for reconsideration. Those are the three aspects we're going to focus on. And clear and convincing evidence, what is it? That's a good question. It's between preponderance of the evidence and proof beyond a reasonable doubt. Preponderance of the evidence means something is more likely true than not, so it's more than 50% if you want to quantify it. Proof beyond a reasonable doubt is probably closer to 99% sure that it's the proof. It's the standard you use for criminal cases. Clear and convincing is in between. It's an order of magnitude higher than preponderance of the evidence, and it's typically been reserved for when you're going to disturb an established fundamental relationship. For example, parental rights terminations require clear and convincing evidence because you're taking somebody's child away from them. So it's a higher bar that is appropriate for that context. Civil commitments, you're taking away somebody's liberty for a period of time. You're committing them for treatment or whatever. That requires clear and convincing evidence. You're altering someone's civil liberties. So that's the context in which that standard has usually been used. It tends to preserve the status quo. The parent keeps the kid until the burden of proof is met. The person remains free until the burden is met to confine them. So in the context of water rights, what is the status quo, so to speak? I think that some of the other testimony you've heard today have indicated that the seniority of your water right and its scope of your water right are determined in an order of determination, and that actually describes, I guess you would say, your property right in water, your seniority. And the rules of the game are that in times of shortage, junior water users may need to be shut off so that senior water users can exercise their water right. That's just the way the system works. And so imposing a clear and convincing standard will make it more difficult for the department, the Water Resources Department, to take action to ensure that, one, that water right holders are using only the water to which they're entitled, and two, that they would be able to take action to shut off junior users if that was going to interfere with the rights of senior users. And I would say in this sense, the regulation we're talking about is really making sure that the rules and the priority system is applied as it was intended to be applied under the priority system we have for water law in the state. And I mentioned the unusual legal aspect that WRD has to set forth its entire case in the written notice, and it's stuck with that under this bill. That's an unusual provision. It's certainly not consistent with the way courts liberally allow amendments and allow evidence that they can fully decide the dispute based on all the evidence that bears on it. And the bills also discourage any attempt by the Water Resources Department to withdraw an order for reconsideration, which we would view as a form of alternative dispute resolution and as a form of streamlining the proceeding. This bill allows a court to override that withdrawal and in addition discourages it by imposing automatic attorney fees and liquidated damages of at least $5,000 if the department withdraws for reconsideration. These are three aspects of the bills that are contrary to the usual approach that has been established in our system, and we take no position on the merit of that, but we wanted to describe what we feel the impact would be.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Committee members, does anyone have anything short questions, hopefully? Gentlemen, thank you very, very much for your appearance. Certainly appreciate it. Thank you very much. With that, I'd like to call up, please, Kurt Martin. And folks, I can't read your writing here. I have a Matt and a Rex. Oh.
I didn't
write that, did I? Did I write that?
No, I did.
Way to go, Brian. Good morning, gentlemen. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning, Chair Witt and committee members. I'm Curtis Martin, recent president of the Oregon Cattlemen's Association, current chair of the Water Resources Committee. I have traveled over 340 miles to testify in favor of House Bill 4044. Even though extreme weather conditions at North Powder are in the single digits and our ranch has over 2,000 head of adult cattle, I felt it very necessary to sacrifice both my time and travel for this extremely important measure because it will affect the entire state of Oregon. Pardon me. The Oregon Supreme Court determined in its Fort Benoit decision that irrigation water rights are property rights. Actions proposed by the Water Resources Department will almost certainly cause many of my member cattlemen irrigators who live and work in the Sprague, Wood, Williamson River Valleys to face the imminent taking of our groundwater irrigation rights. Current statute and rule provides that irrigation wells constructed within a mile of a surface water body are assumed to have the potential to interfere with the surface water, and by no means is this bill intended to interfere with the prior appropriations doctrine, which clearly state first in time, first in right. They also clearly state that the Oregon Water Resources Department bears the burden of proof that the use of each individual well is actually causing interference. It is our understanding the department has completed a modeled groundwater study that the department alleges provides sufficient proof that more than 100 irrigation wells constructed in the Wood, Sprague, and Williamson River Valleys in northern Klamath County are interfering with the adjudicated surface water rights with superior priority dates. The department has shifted the burden of proof of interference from the department to the well owner to prove that their well does not interfere by applying the findings of this modeled groundwater study. The department has essentially created an extensive pseudo-critical groundwater area by applying the findings of this model study. Further, the department has stated their intention to regulate, condition, or shut down all of these wells by their priority dates pursuant to the next call on the adjudicated surface water. It appears that the affected well owners will have little recourse because they would apparently have to disprove the relevance of the entire study in order to disprove the allegation that each of their individual wells is causing interference.
Kurt, could you summarize the rest of your...
Okay.
Half of my time.
All right.
Our further concern is that the department will use the same methodology to regulate groundwater use in the other watersheds throughout Oregon if it is allowed to deprive our Klamath County members the use of their certificated irrigation wells in this manner. We strongly believe the doctrine of prior appropriations, first in use, is first in right. When a well is shown to interfere with the use of the senior water right, it should be regulated. However, we do believe that current statute and rule requires this department to establish proof of interference based upon case-by-case, well-by-well empirical evidence. House Bill 4044 clarifies that the department must develop the proof and the use of each individual irrigation well will cause quantifiable and substantial interference within 180 days before the department can force the well owner to discontinue its use. We strongly support the bill because it helps to protect our members' groundwater irrigation property rights from being taken by the Oregon Water Resources Department. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sir, you have 1 minute remaining.
Thank you. Matt Cyrus, Deschutes County Farm Bureau. Appreciate your time. I'll be real brief. Mostly, very much support this bill. I think it's important to recognize the due process. If these wells are going to be shut off, they need to go through the process. Water rights are a property right, just as land is, and should be afforded the same protections. There shouldn't be the ability to, as a blanket, shut off hundreds of wells. Everyone is individual. Each one was approved separately on its own merits, its own aquifer, own specifics. They should be shut off in the same manner and same due process as would be afforded property rights.
Thank you very much. Good job in the timing.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning.
Representatives, my name is Rex Barber. I farm in the Deschutes Basin, west of Terrebonne. We went through a similar exercise in the Deschutes Basin 10 or 15 years ago and came up with a solution that I might say nobody liked and nobody hated it. So we came up with a pretty good solution. So I say that to encourage you that there is a solution out there. But I am in favor of the proposed legislation, but more importantly, I'm here to caution that the Water Resources Department, I believe, is overstepping their bounds. As Senator Whitsitt has testified and Representative McLean and others, the Water Resources Department to regulate the wells in this matter must create a critical groundwater area. Otherwise, they need to evaluate each individual well, and regulation has to be both timely and effective. They have to establish a quantity and they have to establish timing. There's also another standard, and that standard is substantial interference. That's a legal term that I'm not here to try to define for you, but it is a legal term in rule, in statute, that recognizes that junior users may interfere with senior users as long as it isn't substantial and not detrimental to the senior water right. So to sum it up, my main concern is with the apparent overstepping of the authority of the Water Resources Department to throw a blanket over this area and regulate wells. I believe it needs to be done on an individual basis. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Questions or comments? Yes, Representative Clem, please.
I don't know if this is for the right group. I need to wait for someone from the Klamath Basin to come up here, probably.
Okay. All right, very good.
Well, Curtis is kind of in there, aren't you?
No.
Powder, yeah.
He's over in another basin.
Yeah, no, that's right.
How'd you do in geography?
I forgot where he's from for a second. I've been out there to see him out there. I forgot.
Gentlemen, thank you very, very much. And recognize that, Kurt, you may have the record here of having traveled the greatest distance.
Yeah.
Thank you.
In fact, I had to fly out there the last time to see him, if I remember right. A long ways, too.
While we're calling, if Kimberly, Tom Wolf, Kimberly, I can't read their last name, and Angela could come up, please.
I have another 100 miles.
Yep, we got
it. Sorry, I'm having difficulty reading the writing here this morning.
And then Eric. Eric, are you? I think Eric.
Good morning, this is Eric Quince.
Good morning. This is the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee, and I'm Chair Witt. We are interested in your comments on House Bills 4064 and 4044. Could you please identify yourself for the record and give us your comments on that? We'd like to be able to limit it to 2 minutes, please.
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Witt, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Eric Klimps. I'm the Natural Resources Director of the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, and we appreciate the opportunity to submit the comments on behalf of the Tribal Water Commission and the Board of Trustees. You have our written comments, so I'll be brief. The tribe is concerned that these bills would negatively impact the tribe's water rights settlement and the Umatilla Basin. As you're aware, the tribe is in water rights settlement negotiations, and those negotiations involve the United States, the state, the Umatilla Basin, the irrigation districts, and ditch companies and other stakeholders, and those negotiations are aggressive and constructive, and once the product of those negotiations will be a settlement that establishes the tribe's in-stream flows and out-of-stream consumptive uses. And in order to protect those rights once they're settled, we will rely on well-established prior appropriation doctrine. We think that the bills would impose additional effort and expenses on Oregon Water Resources Department. We have a statutory obligation to protect senior water rights. We think this is a particular issue in the Umatilla Basin where water rights have long been over-appropriated, and we're concerned that OWRD would require extra time and cost to deny or limit new water right applications or groundwater permits. that their ability to protect senior water rights would be negatively impacted. So the tribe respectfully requests that the committee reject these bills, as we do not see a benefit to our water rights settlement efforts, Umatilla Basin, or the state.
Thank you very much. And is it pronounced Quince?
Quince.
Quince. Thank you very much, Mr. Quince. Committee members, do we have questions or comments here?
No.
I'm not seeing any. Thank you so very, very much for your testimony, and we certainly appreciate the fact that you were willing to make yourself available by telephone.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Have a good day.
You too.
Thank you. Bye now.
Bye.
Panel members, welcome. I'm going to let you jump right into it here.
Chair Witt, members of the commission, or committee, sorry. My name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch has been around for almost 30 years, and we work to protect and restore stream flows statewide. We have submitted extensive comments. I won't go through those here today, but I did want to touch upon some of the conversation that has been happening here today. First of all, on the clear and convincing evidence standard, as we heard from others, that does raise the bar, so it is a higher bar. But the bill goes beyond that by defining in the bill what clear and convincing evidence is. Specifically, it requires the department to provide clear and convincing evidence, not generally, but specific to each well. So it's an even higher bar. And this is problematic, from our point of view. This is problematic because under this standard, the WRD would essentially be banned from using USGS studies and or peer-reviewed science that's been in the making for, you know, decades, as we heard from the scientists earlier. But also, as we heard earlier today from the USGS, according to the USGS, they said it is not possible to determine interference between a well and a surface water. And therefore, the standard of clear and convincing evidence as outlined in the bill, which requires the finding between the well and the surface water, is just simply not achievable. And so the result of that is the department, as written, the department would not be able to regulate off groundwater rights in favor of senior surface water rights. And so that is a real problem. It's not just regulation of the groundwater rights in favor of senior surface water rights, including farmers, cities, in-stream, the whole gamut of users.
Kimberly, we've run out of time.
Oh, I have. Darn. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, committee members, for the record, my name is Tom Wolf, Executive Director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. Trout Unlimited is a large national group composed of fishermen who are concerned about conservation issues, in particular water issues and watershed issues. I'm not going to go into any of the stuff that's covered by my learned colleague Kimberly and others who have testified against this bill. First of all, Trout Unlimited does oppose both these bills. Where I'm going to go is this bill, both these bills put tremendous pressure on the agencies. We ask natural resource agencies to do terrible things and give them a lot of work, because we ask them not only to manage for conservation means, whether it be ODFW for Fish and Wildlife, Department of Forestry for forestry, or water resources for in-stream flow and groundwater. We ask them to make sure that there's enough of in their areas that the user groups, whether it be hunter fishermen, commercial fishermen, loggers, or farmers, have enough for their needs. It's a tremendous burden we ask them to do, and I'm surprised that more of them don't go to the top of their buildings and jump off. But it's a tough issue, and this bill would cause a lot more hardship to the Water Resources Department. It would cost more time, more effort, and more money, and I don't think that's fair. I think that we shouldn't be legislating this sort of issue, and I certainly sympathize with the farmers in the Klamath Basin. I grew up in places like Wallowa County, Umatilla County, Clatsop County, and have cousins and friends that farm in all those areas. So I sympathize with the farmers and their needs, but this is not, these bills are not the answer. We need to have further discussions between these farmers and water resources to come up with a solution that will be best for all. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Perfect timing.
Angela Crowley Cook, Legislative Director for Oregon Environmental Council.
Good morning.
Good morning. First, on a lighter note, if anyone knows that well-paid environmental lobbyist, I'd love to meet them. I clearly need some career advice. So, Chair Witt, members of the committee, others have really covered the science and the specifics about water law related to this tonight. We submitted written testimony, so I'll keep this very short. One of our great concerns, we oppose HB 4044 and 4046, and one of the main reasons is because it would, I mean, as we've heard today, the Klamath Basin is a very complicated water system, and there are a lot of interests, and it's a very hard issue to solve. And so our concern is that these bills would make it more difficult for the Water Resources Department to permit and regulate groundwater. And so that's not, we feel, the direction that we need to go, especially in a very complicated area. Thanks very much.
Thank you all very much. Yes, Senator Whitsitt, please.
Thank you. First, a comment. I'm not too particularly concerned about hardships to the department. I'm concerned the hardships about my constituents.
People.
Ms. Priestley, on the let's say if in this situation in Klamath, instead of being 100 wells or 150 wells, if it was one well, mm-hmm. is it your testimony that it would be impossible to determine if that one well was interfering?
As I understand the testimony of, I'm sorry, Chair Witt, members of the committee, as I understand the testimony earlier, under this standard that requires, under the clear and convincing evidence, and the standard that requires that clear and convincing evidence be tied to a particular well, yes, the department, our assessment is the department would not be able to regulate that well off to the harm of senior surface water right holders.
Is it your position, follow-up, is it your position under the current preponderance of evidence standard that the same question, would the agency be able to determine interference on a single well?
We believe that the agency has the tools with the USGS studies and other...
That's not what I ask. On a single well?
Yes. Under the current standard, they could regulate off if in favor of a senior surface water right holder.
Thank you.
Correct.
Could I just say one thing?
Yes,
we'll make it brief. This bill has nothing to do with not using USGS or any other source in addition to clarifying by scientific empirical methods. I don't want anybody to leave this room and think that this bill has anything to do with not allowing other sources of information. Just to clarify.
Chair Witt, Representative Whitsett, I appreciate that sentiment, and I'm just looking at this as with a strict reading of the bill, and our assessment is because clear and convincing evidence is defined in the bill, that would preclude use of the USGS model that is a general overlay. If that were taken out, if it were just clear and convincing evidence, it is our assessment that the USGS model would meet that standard. We think it would, but it's just the definition that narrows it down to a well to surface water connection. That is what makes this provision especially troubling, because it simply cannot be met, is our assessment.
Okay, and I recognize that this may be a point of conjecture, and I'm going to have to leave it as a point of conjecture at this point. With that, panel members, thank you very, very much. Next, please, I'm going to call forward W.D. Kennedy, Katie Fast, and who am I missing? I'm missing someone. Kelsey Ferry.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm going to have to leave, but I would like to make it clear, it appears that the state Water Resources Department is already, under the present law, required to make the determination on the individual well. And they're using a 2007 study to circumvent that, but I would contend at the time of the 2007 study, they were not aware of the adjudication and the particulars about it. So trying to apply it, I don't think it was designed to be used for that purpose.
Okay. Thank you for that, making that point. Representative Clem?
Yeah, and I'm not sure these people are the right people, but the thing I guess I want to make sure before we go to the floor in 9 minutes, I get an answer to at some point is, when I heard the folks say we got our water shut off at some time so we dug wells, I assume they're agricultural wells. And what I want to get at some point is, did the department approve that?
We're going to be hearing from the department after this panel.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to make it to my time to have to leave, but we'll try.
All right, please proceed. Welcome.
Chairman Witt and all of your representatives and senators, thank you for your service. I'd like to answer that question before I do my testimony. My name is William Kennedy. I'm a rancher in Klamath Falls. The first regulatory drought in Klamath Falls was in 1991 when the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service circumvented irrigation to almost 30,000 acres. At that time, my family spent close to $500,000 developing groundwater, and we did receive a limited use permit as a conditional use as a supplemental source for that groundwater. And that was pretty typical in 1991. That wasn't very typical in 2001.
Okay, please proceed. I'm going to have to adjourn here shortly.
Thank you again for hearing me. I hope that everyone can hear me with this sound system.
Move it back from a little bit.
Yeah. Closer to you. All right, great. Thank you very much. My name is William Kennedy. My two daughters and I ranch on 2,000 acres in Klamath County. We rely on groundwater. Our ranch lands are all designated as private wildlife refuge, and we provide premium habitat for waterfowl, raptors, and wonderful coyotes. I'm also a member of Klamath Irrigation District, and I'm a member of the Water Users Association. I'm not on their boards, but I want to make it clear that they do not represent me, and I do not represent them. I support this legislation. I want to make point once again that this is specific to groundwater, and it does affect the whole state. The House bill underlines and codifies the current statutory responsibility of the Water Resource Department when regulating groundwater use. Without this legislation, we find the Water Resource Department manipulating the interpretation of their authority to a point that causes economic, environmental injury. This bill is written to save the Water Resource Department from itself and to save the economies of our Oregon communities from economic damage. This legislation will require the Water Resource Department to use sound and verifiable science to determine hydraulic connection between groundwater and surface water or other groundwater before they regulate. Pretty simple. The Water Resource Department may argue that their computer modeling process is sound and verifiable. I disagree. While computer modeling is a useful tool for groundwater research, it is far from sound and it is often unverified. Instead, this computer modeling is often generalized, influenced by science, political science. I give you two potential examples of in my county where this legislation is important in directing the Water Resource Department. This year, there's a list of close to 100 groundwater sources that the Water Resource Department plans to regulate off because of, quote, potential to interfere in the
And we're out of time. I'm sorry.
God bless you. I'll send you a copy of my testimony.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Oregon Farm Bureau supports the concepts in House Bill 4044 and 4046. I have been hearing for several years concerns from my members statewide that the department is basing many of their groundwater policies without sound and enough data. And those policies relate to the drilling of new wells and the regulatory and interference of surface water and groundwater. I think it's very important to note that this bill, while it impacts what's going to happen this next year in Klamath Falls, is really about groundwater policies for the entire state. We do not believe that this bill is intended to undermine the prior appropriations doctrine, something that my members hold very dearly to the importance of regulating water in a sound and meaningful manner. But to do this, the department must have the data to know that junior water right holders are impacting senior water right holders before they are cut off and regulated. We recognize that the level and the burden of proof in this bill will require a large, probably fiscal statement from the department. However, the actions that they will take forward are going to have even more of an impact to the livelihoods of our members throughout the state. With that, I think this session we are requesting that this department set up a work group to discuss this bill in more detail and see if there are some compromises available that can set up a system that the department's making their decisions based on sound data that they can administer in an efficient manner. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much.
Chair Witt, Vice Chair Escobal, Vice Chair Fredericks, and committee, thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony today. My name is Kelsey Ferry, and I've lived in Lakeview, Oregon my entire life. Lakeview is 90 miles east of Klamath Falls, and I want to testify today regarding the impacts on support businesses in our rural communities. My parents own one of these support businesses, and we own and operate a veterinarian practice in Lakeview. I started working there walking dogs when I was 8 years old, and I've worked there off and on over the years. My father employs at least 13 people and has employed many more members of the community throughout the years. The drought and cutoff won't just affect the ranchers and farmers, but our communities as a whole. Our community relies on agriculture production for our survival. Klamath County has a 10.3% unemployment rate already. With this impending drought, that number will increase dramatically. Many community members will have no choice but to close their businesses and move away. When this happens, those businesses that support our nonprofit programs and services for those of limited means suffer greatly. It affects the booster clubs, arts and culture, Little League, and education. Agriculture is what makes our communities thrive, and without it in Klamath County, without it, everybody in Klamath County will suffer, not just the ranchers. Therefore, I'm here to speak on behalf of my family business, Lakeview Animal Hospital, in favor of House Bill 4044. And for full disclosure purposes, I'm currently working as an LA for Representative Gail Whitsett. Thank you, Chair, Vice Chair Escobal, and Vice Chair Fredericks.
Thank you very, very much. We have time for 1 minute's questions. Representative Reardon?
One quick question. If we had more time, I'd be tempted to say something about how seriously we take this issue and understand that what we're talking about drastically affects people's lives. We don't have any time, so simple question. Everybody's talking about, I think, maybe more data on an individual well. If there is a call by a senior water right, are we really talking about more data from over 100 wells and that would occur? We'd have to go out and check those wells at one time. Is that the scenario that we're talking about?
I think there's some technicality involved that I cannot answer, but my perception is that what we're requesting is specific information for the well that is proposed to be shut down. That's what's vital. It's that information very specific to that well. We have a very compartmentalized aquifer, and the cartoons, besides not including a coyote or a roadrunner, also did not include some of the dynamics of on-the-ground real-world situations. That was a very good presentation in theoretical groundwater modeling, but it's not the real world on those cartoons.
And with that, thank you to each and every one of you. We appreciate your testimony very much. I would like to just inform the public that because I have run out of time and have not had enough time to allow the department to present its opinion on these bills, I'm gonna provide that opportunity at a later date. I gave proponents as much time as they wanted. I am going to provide the department with an adequate amount of time to present their feelings as well. And with that, our committee. Oh, I would just want to comment. This was a most civil and most respectful set of hearings. You are all great Oregonians. Thank you all so very, very much for your input in the record. With that, we stand adjourned. With that, we stand adjourned.